So I'm going to be talking about craving and contentment, or freedom from craving. There's a lot of material on this, and it's good stuff. I mean, I recommend that you read The Ten Pillars, Know Your Mind, Living Ethically, Living Wisely. They've all got stuff to say about craving, which is hardly surprising because it's such a basic sort of Buddhist category, I suppose. So, craving, Sanskrit raga or lobha. Those are the two words that are both used in the original languages for craving. Raga means colour or dye or hue. So there's the connotation that your mental states are sort of dyed with coloured. You know, when you dye a t-shirt red from white, that's dyeing. Yeah. So that your mind is sort of dyed, coloured, tainted, if you like, by negative mental states. Lobha, just means craving. Subhuti talks about these as cupidity attachment and passionate attachment. But there are sort of things to be said about all of these. Subhuti makes the difference, and so does Banti actually, that it's not particularly good to think about craving as desire, because desire can have positive connotations, as in Trishna or Tanha. Those are the two words. Trishna is Sanskrit, Tanha is Pali, which literally means thirst. So you can thirst for the Dharma, you can thirst for freedom, for enlightenment. So it can be skillful or unskillful. So both Subhuti and Banti sort of rule out using desire. Subhuti talks about longing and clinging under craving. Longing is the desire for pleasant objects that you don't yet have. And clinging is the desire to keep hold of the pleasant objects that you imagine yourself to have. I say imagine because we never really have anything, do we? But we won't go there for the moment. For me, the classic sort of definition for craving comes from Human Enlightenment, page 57. I think Banti says these are from some sort of Tibetan source. As far as I'm concerned, it's the fullest definition of the three roots. So I do suggest you look those up, because ignorance and hatred are also very good and couched in the same terms. So craving, Banti says, is a longing desire to possess objects of sensuous cognition which you like, and to include them in your ego identity in the hope of getting a sense of security from having them as part of you. Yeah, it's quite a sort of full, complex definition. Yeah, longing desire to possess objects of sensuous cognition which you like, attraction, to include them in your ego identity in the hope of getting a sense of security from having them as part of you. So the implication is that we don't have a sense of security. Yeah, that's why we grab these things and stick them on us, and hope that they'll make us more and make us secure. Everything that can be an object of mind can be an object of craving. Mind in Harmony, page 127. So it can be a thing, any sort of thing that you can think of, a house, a car, a person, an event, an experience, a feeling, past, present or future, a memory or a fantasy, a single idea, collections of ideas, a view or collections of views, political ideas, religious ideas. I liked Subhuti's little quote on page 124, where he says, "People will kill or die for an idea, and not necessarily a good one." Yeah, but they'll still kill or be prepared to die for it. I thought that was very apt. I shouldn't really go into this. I'll mention it, though. We were warned off it at the beginning. All sense objects, according to the Yogacara, are mental objects. Yeah? All sense objects. All those things I talked about before, even things like cars, a house, a person, they're all mental objects in the final analysis, yeah? Because of the intricacies of our perceptions. Yeah? Our sense organs and brain deliver representations of an object out there to us, yeah? But usually without a lifetime of training, our interpretation of the perception is deeply flawed. It's completely out of kilter with the way things actually are. But that, we end up thinking, is the way things are. You know, this sort of out of kilter perception that we have. We tell ourselves a story about the object and then we believe it. That's usually what we do. We exaggerate the pleasant aspects of the object and its ability to give us pleasure and happiness, and we conceal from ourselves or minimise the painful aspects of the object. I mean, in a way, Dhammadipa mentioned quite a bit of this in this first talk. So craving is one of the three roots that drive samsara, along with ignorance and hatred. I think it's probably the most obvious of the three. Ignorance, although it's Buddhism says it's more basic, I think it probably is more basic, but unfortunately we swim in ignorance like fish in water. Yeah, it's so close to us. We breathe it, we smell it, we think it. It's so close to us that we just don't notice that we've got it. Yeah. It's there all the time and we don't sort of see it. Hatred, I think, as well, can be superficially brushed aside as sort of just, well, it's frustrated craving. I can't get what I want, and that's thoroughly justified for me to get, you know, angry and upset about things. People find a lot of ways of justifying their upset, don't they, usually? For some reason, I don't know, I've never thought of this before, but something came back to me from when I was a little boy. I lived in this main road in Ilford, and just down the road, about three blocks away, was a toy shop. And my brother and I used to spend a lot of time looking in the window of the toy shop at the toys. And I was particularly into toy soldiers, particularly cowboys and Indians. So, you know, I'd sort of save up and buy one of these toy soldiers. I can remember the paradigm, the real sort of classic event was an Indian with a bow and arrow riding on a horse, and you could take him off the horse. But I got really sort of obsessed with this figure. Spent, you know, ages saving up to buy it, and then when I got it, I can remember. I think I bought it on the Friday, and by Sunday I'd got fed up with it. And I knew there was something about this that was rather odd. And this scenario just kept happening. I'd sort of, you know, I'd put it on the pile with the other soldiers, and I'd be back at the toy shop halfway through the next week, drooling over the next one. I knew there was something odd about this sort of pattern, but I had no context in which to put it. So I just thought I'd share that with you. And I think it was just basically craving. But I didn't think in those terms. My family didn't think of those terms. I had no context whatsoever to put that experience in. But it was very strong, and I knew that it was going on. Strange. So spiritual ignorance and craving represent the basic and general condition of unenlightened samsaric existence. And they are the last samsaric tendencies to be eroded before attaining arahatship or complete Buddhahood. Sagarmati, Western Buddhist Review, number 2, page 147. Yeah? That's where he goes into the whole business of tanha and thirst. I think the article is called Three Cheers for Tanha. Without thirst for the Dharma, spiritual life would be impossible. But I like that quote. Spiritual ignorance and craving represent the basic and general condition of unenlightened samsaric existence. That's what we're like. Spiritual ignorance and craving are symbolic of the way things are, as far as we're concerned, in a sort of unenlightened, subjective sense. Or at least that's how they seem to be. You know, all our sort of skewed data adds up to this being the way things are. This is the Kama Loka. Kama Loka, yeah? K-A-M-A-L-O-K-A. Not karma, Kama. And we can change it. That's what's important about this. We can change this this sort of attitude to the way things seem to be. Because of our sense of insecurity in the face of impermanence and death, we can even crave existence. And even, in extreme circumstances, non-existence, which may seem bizarre. But when life gives us more pain than pleasure, and we can see no escape, we may then crave non-existence. And I think it's Subhuti says that this isn't really a rejection of existence itself. It's just a rejection of our current experience of it. In a way, it's the result of frustrated worldliness. We can't get the world to work. It's not giving us what we want. In fact, it's so painful, we just want out. But that, he says, that's not existence itself. It's more like, it's all too much. It's all too much. And I know, well, I've been there from time to time, and I know lots of other people have as well. Craving goes very deep. It's subtle and refined. And it's not just about having another extra piece of chocolate. Yeah, it's much more complex than that. Craving is a mula klesha, a mula klesha. So mula means root. So it's the basic. Yeah, and klesha means that which torments or that which defiles. It's a negative emotion, and it's something we do. We do craving. So we can ask ourselves, you know, well, how do I do craving? What are my patterns for doing craving? You might like to follow that up in the group. So this means that our actions of body, speech and mind are vitally important, as Dharmadipa said on the first night. And that's why ethics are important. Yeah, ethics are important as well, because craving is what we're doing and it has an effect. Springing from craving, the root defilement or the root torment, come the upakleshas. So, klesha I've said was, wherever it was, what I said. Upa just means secondary. Yeah, so it's a secondary affliction. It sort of comes under the umbrella of craving proper. Subhuti calls them the branches from the main trunk. And we need to look at these and try and recognise them in our experience. So the first of these is avarice, which I think in Know Your Mind is matsarya. This is identifying happiness with having things. Having things rather than using them or enjoying them. So it's very much, it's acquisitiveness, yeah? It's collecting things. I must admit I'm prone to this myself to quite a large extent. Based on the rationalisation very often that the things I collect may come in useful in the future. That's my main rationalisation. But, I mean, some of them are completely ridiculous. Like, for instance, I do have a thing about boxes. You know, nice little boxes. And it's a giveaway, really, because, you know, with boxes, you put things in boxes. So I'm lining myself up for a tragedy, aren't I? I'm collecting these things that I need to fill with other things. So it's basically madness. I can't have enough boxes. They're my boxes. They're my boxes, yeah? So I become quite miserly about boxes. You know, I'm always on the lookout for a good box. And if there's one that doesn't seem to be particularly owned by anyone, I have it. This is what I'm like. So What do you do? What's your little peccadillo? Yeah, mine's boxes. What's yours? It seems that we can even have this attitude with the Dharma. An accumulation of knowledge can become avarice. It can be picked up without practicing it or wanting to share it. And you do come across this. I've certainly come across this or seen this in other people. The antidote to this, of course, is generosity. What I should do is give my boxes away to the four quarters, and anybody who wants one, I should become a sort of a contact point for anybody who needs a box. There are three other upaklesas as well, and Subhuti sort of groups these together. He says they come as a sort of a collection, progressive stages of the impulse to disguise one's true nature or intentions. Yeah. Hiding one's faults from other people in a more or less deliberate and sort of obvious kind of way. You could say it's being a good Buddhist. I think this is what Subhuti says. It's being a good Buddhist so that the desire to appear good overtakes the desire to be good. So you're much more concerned about looking good than actually being good. And being good sort of goes out the window. Yeah. Subhuti says these are progressively degenerative. So the first of these is concealment, mraksha. One is sly, one doesn't tell lies or pretend, one's just craftily concealing the truth, usually about what you're up to, yeah, what you do and stuff like that. In communities, it's the, where was he last night, syndrome, you know, like somebody, you know, you've got somebody in the community and they disappear and nobody quite, they've not said where they've gone, they sort of breeze in the next morning as if they've always been there. Sort of, you don't like to ask because they've done it so sort of, in such a sort of slippery way, a mysterious way that it makes it difficult to challenge them. They've got this air of sort of sanctimoniousness kind of thing. One makes one's communication vague and foggy so that one can't be challenged. Therefore, one doesn't have to change. I called it slippery. Also, another expression I use is non-stick. Yeah, sometimes people are a bit non-stick. You try and find out what they've been up to and you engage with them, but you just sort of slip off. Yeah, there's nothing to sort of get hold of. They're a bit ghost-like. It's as if they're not fully engaged because you can't engage with them. They're making sure that they're disengaged so that nobody finds out what they're actually like and what they're actually up to. As I say, this is done very sort of surreptitiously. It's not really a sort of lie or anything. It's quite devious, I suppose. The next one is pretense, maya, and this goes a step further. One actually creates a false appearance. Subhuti's example, which I like and I've seen this loads of times, you spend a lot of time sitting on after a meditation, even though your mind is completely all over the place, yeah? But, you know, it looks good. Everybody else is going out and he's still sitting there. That's interesting. Go on, you know. Maybe he's having a good meditation. You're not having a good meditation, but it looks good. You know, you're a meditator kind of thing. You get a lot of that kind of thing. Or, well, there are other versions as well, yeah. This counters the behaviour one performs in private that doesn't fit the image. Yeah? So you've got, this is becoming much more consciously sort of devious, if you like. And it brings to mind immediately, you know, Subhuti's classic question, what are one's ethics in the private moment? What do you do when the doors are closed and it's just you on your own and nobody's looking? What do you get up to? What do you think's all right when you've got the door closed and there's nobody looking? That's the big one. It's a very, very interesting question to ask yourself. Next one is deceit. I've omitted to put any Pali or Sanskrit term to that. This is the telling of outright lies to preserve advantage and reputation. The antidote to these is opening up and revealing one's private moments to one's spiritual friends. Confession, if you like. Subhuti says the more... Is it Subhuti or is it Bhante? I'm not sure. The more reluctant we feel to reveal, the more necessary it is to do it. Yeah, because if we feel reluctant to reveal, we're backing away. We're not engaging with the people that we should be engaging with. This reminded me, I suppose I've got quite a bit of time, this reminded me of a piece from the Pali Canon, from the Udana, Woodward, page 62, 5-5. It's the sutta about where the Buddha goes on to talk about the Dharma discipline as being like the mighty ocean. I won't go into all that. But it's the setting is it's a full moon night. And usually the Buddha sort of goes through the pratimoksha, you know, the rules for the monks. And they will chant them after him, kind of thing. But he won't do this if there's anybody in the gathering who's not up to it. And on this particular night, Ananda goes up after the first watch and says, you know, it's getting late, Lord, you know, time for the pratimoksha. And the Buddha's silent, doesn't say anything. And Ananda's quite used to this sort of behaviour. And it happens again with the middle watch of the night. I'm just thinking, well, it's getting on a bit, you know. Pretty much, Lord. Silence. Third time he goes up, and the Buddha says to him, Ananda, the company is not wholly pure. And then Moggallana's sort of hearing this. He's got psychic powers, and he thinks, oh, right. The gathering isn't wholly pure. So he just pans through all the consciousnesses. That's the one, kind of thing. And he picks out the man who's acting a pretense, basically. He's not prepared to open up. So he goes over to this man and says, rise up, good sir. You have been seen by the exalted one. There is no society for you with the monks. Silence. He has to do this three times. And the monk's just pretending. He carries on pretending that he's fine. And he could quite easily have sort of said, okay, fair cop, I'm sorry, you know, like, I confess it all, you know, I've been doing this, that and the other. He probably would have been all right then if he'd done that, but he didn't. So Moggallana grabs him by the arm and throws him out, basically. And then the Buddha says to Moggallana, it is strange, Moggallana, that deluded person should wait until he was led by the arm. I don't know, I've always sort of liked that... And then you get the discourse on the mighty ocean, the eight strange and wonderful things. And the Udana for that, you get the sort of the prose bit, and then at the end you get a sort of little poetic piece from the Buddha. And the Buddha's Udana for that is, it rains through the thatch, it rains not through the open. So open up the thatch, then it will not rain through. So what this means is if you're doing a partial cover-up, things are going to get through that, yeah? You have to open up the thatch. If you open up completely, there's no problem, really. If you're completely honest about what's going on, there's nothing to rain through. So open up the thatch. Where am I? Right. Right, that comes there, good. To the extent that we're not prepared to open up to others, I would say, to that extent we cut ourselves off from those who we should be closest to, our spiritual friends. We must become ever more transparent to each other if we're to establish an effective Sangha. That's what Sangha is, it's transparency. And this is very difficult. I know it's very difficult at first because it takes a lot of courage, I suppose. But to the extent that you have done any confession, you'll know that it just lightens one's load on the conscience. Yeah, the conscience can be sort of cleaned, if you like. And it's a great relief just to be able to tell people the things that you've done. And usually your own opinion of what you've done is far worse than what other people think of it. Yeah, we tend to sort of absolutize our bad behavior very often and think that it's completely beyond the pale. And sometimes you see sort of older members, you know, you'll come out with your confession and they'll sort of go, yeah. I've been there, yeah, I know that one. Okay, that's all the nasty stuff. Now contentment. So this is alobha. So lobha, if you remember, was craving and cupidity, attachment, passionate attachment. So unfortunately, it's just couched in the Pali in as not craving. Yeah, but it's much, much more than that. Contentment, we can say, is the complete opposite of concealment, pretense, and deceit. There's much more than just detachment. The trouble with detachment as a term, which is how it's often translated, it suggests that we're being removed from something which has been or still could be, we could still be attracted to. Yeah, so it's like a sort of temporary thing. We just detach ourselves from it for a while, rather than actually cutting it off completely. So contentment is much more than that. It's much more than non-attachment even. It's the absence of attachment. It's a very, very positive mental activity in its own right. Subhuti says it's the basis for accomplishing good deeds. It's a state of individuality, independence, freedom, and creativity, a state of equilibrium. And Subhuti uses this traditional image, which I think I've never come across this before, but I think it's wonderful. The image for contentment is like a piece of thistle down blown on the wind. Yeah? You're just free and floating. I think it's a lovely image. Ultimately, contentment is freedom from samsara, freedom from the three worlds, the world of sense desire, the world of archetypal form, and the world of no form. Even freedom from the most refined levels of experience, including those in meditation. Yeah? You're even free of those. You don't get attached to those even. So how do we go about this? How do we develop contentment? And Bhante says in Know Your Mind, page 129, by being selectively and consciously attached to what is skillful and positive. So this is, if you like, this is the thirst. This is the desire in a positive sense. We've got to selectively and consciously attach to what's skillful and what's positive. Just exchange one for the other, basically. Subhuti talks about an experience of loss of dignity, which comes very much into the territory we've already covered, haven't we, with shame. And I can certainly sort of relate to this myself. I can remember him talking about this in the old days. It's like sometimes you do something and you know you've sort of let yourself down. Yeah, you've sort of missed the mark, even in your own sort of your own evaluation. And there's a sort of loss of dignity. And a sense of humiliation, self-demeaning even, but in a very positive sense. You know you just haven't really done it. One's fallen below one's own best and wants to experience something purer and truer. And this, I think we can say, is the beginnings of renunciation. And again, I think it's Subhuti or Bhante, one of them says... that it's a sense of renunciation that a sensitive mind can experience as it sits with restlessness and boredom. Doing nothing is another way of experiencing contentment. Because, I mean, there is this New Age saying, isn't there? There's nothing I need right now that I don't already have. But I think you have to sit down and do nothing for quite a while before you come to that realisation. There's always, I don't know, for me, certainly for a long time, I can remember I used to have a sort of hit list of things that I needed to get and have And there was no end to it, and I couldn't come to the end of it. But if I could, then I'd be all right. But of course I couldn't. I never did. Another way of cultivating contentment is cultivating sensuous experience that's not associated with craving, obviously. So that's Banti's emphasis on being in nature, enjoying nature, engaging with and enjoying the fine arts. I know some people find this difficult. I mean, I come from a working class background, and I didn't know anything about the fine arts when I got into the movement. But by association with my friends in the good life, I just picked things up. And over time, I developed a sort of an interest in that, an interest in the fine arts. I mean, I'm not particularly knowledgeable in poetry or fine art, but I've got an interest in them now that I certainly didn't have when I first came along. The other way is deep communication. And the way to deep communication, of course, is confession, opening up, being transparent. We also need to be, again, Subhuti, detached from the three times. And I found this quite an interesting little set of ideas as well. We need to detach from the past. We don't crave the past, yeah? There's no sense of nostalgia. We don't crave what's being given up when the spiritual life gets difficult. I mean, this is very difficult again, isn't it? I know, you're having a sort of so-so meditation and you're looking for some interest or some energy. So, you know, what was the last encounter I had with Miss X? Oh, yeah, right. And suddenly you're replaying it, yeah? Nostalgia. Negative attachment to the past. So when the spiritual life gets difficult, I mean, we can do it outside of meditation as well. If things get very difficult, that's what we do. We start to think, maybe I was all right before I came along to this stuff. It all seems so difficult and life's so complicated now. I was at ease before. But of course, you didn't have any sense of value, so it's hardly surprising, really. When our inspiration is at a low ebb, we may be tempted to revert to cravings from the past. So we need to watch out for that. Well, I suppose we need to identify what are our cravings from the past that we're still disconnecting from, because they probably haven't gone. And as I say, in our weaker moments, we'll fall back on them. We'll fall back into them. Present. This, again, I found very interesting. Subhuti puts it as craving the mundane benefits of the spiritual life. Being admired, given presence, being respected, considered an authority. The big one is you're a meditation teacher. I know lots of people are quite interested in being a meditation teacher. Having some sort of status or influence, even in our own, as he puts it, small little Buddhist world, yeah, there are some people you can see have obviously got, they've got their eye on a badge, you know, I'm the top meditator kind of thing. So we need to watch out for that. And then the future, in a way, is a sort of bit more of the same. This is a sort of calculated renunciation now of material things in the expectation that you get them all back with interest later on. When you become that, that authority, that person with status and influence, everybody will look up to you. You'll get lots of bars of chocolate and people will like you and they'll take you for walks and all that kind of thing. So you're sort of working to get that together. As a dharma career, if you like, I suppose. You're practicing to achieve being admired, respected, influential, or a meditation teacher, or a good study leader, you know, a reputation, that kind of thing. It's interesting that I don't suppose he's giving any secrets away, but one of the statements that makes us cringe on the ordination team very often. I hope this doesn't apply to anybody here. Is, you know, you get a mitre who's, they've asked for ordination for, you know, like about 6 months ago, and they said, I really want to teach. I said, oh, right. But inside we're going, da 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 da, the alarm bells are going off. What does this guy think he's doing? Where does he think he's going? He really wants to teach. What does he know? Sometimes it's a little bit sad. I mean, it's quite difficult to tell people about that kind of thing. But as I say, my alarm bells certainly go off when somebody tells me that, you know, quite early on that that's what they want to do. They want to teach. Do they know if they're any good at it? Do they have a, you know, an intellectual strength? Can they put two Dharmic concepts together? Very often they can't, but it's a sort of an idea. We get this idea in our heads that there's something to aim for in the short term. I mean, maybe it's just because we talked about this in our group today. It's quite difficult to see what where you're going and what the next sort of goal is. I think in a way the next goal, even as a mitra is asked for ordination, and especially if you're an order member, the next goal is to be a good Kalyana mitra. I think anybody can do that if they can learn to communicate and be open. Then they can become a good Kalyana mitra. I've never heard a mitra say that to me, I don't think. Oh yeah, when I get all done, I want to be a good Kalyana mitra. But then I think, oh, you know, this is somebody to watch, kind of thing. So contentment is the positive that drives out craving. It's self and ego taken out of the way. A good question to ask yourself when you catch yourself craving is, do I always want to be like this? Do I want to be doing this for the rest of my life? Even if I don't have anything to do with Buddhism, do I want to keep doing this? Because usually craving is you get what you want, and then it's like the toy soldier. Next. Next kind of thing. It never satisfies. It never satisfies. The more we can let go, the more peace and satisfaction we will experience. That's all I have to say on this subject at the present time.